Committee. Today we're going to hear three bills before we continue the testimony on global warming and climate change. Senator Kubley is with us to talk about his three bills. So we'll start off with Senate File 538, Senator Kubley.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. 538 is a bill that I've come up with primarily because of some of the applications of geothermal systems that I've become somewhat personally acquainted with. You know, it does seem to me that that it's a pretty viable option for use in state buildings, and this one does ask the commissioner, and that's the Commissioner of Administration, to review geothermal applications. You know, when we get requests in here to the state for replacement of boilers and air conditioning units, those are pretty expensive things, and usually they're seeking some bonding dollars to do that. It just seems to me that it would be beneficial for the state if we could look at something like the geothermal applications. There's really a wide range of payback times that that people have. I know some friends of ours put geothermal into their retirement home, which is built on Lake Edward up north of Brainerd, Minnesota. And they believe, you know, they moved from a home that had you know, roughly the same number of square feet in it, within 20 square feet, and they feel that the savings to their utility bills allowed them to pay for their geothermal system in a little less than 6 years. There are others that say that the payback time is, you know, 12, 14 years, but if you notice the handouts that you have in your packet, members, there's one there from the from a building, the Civic Center in the city of Appleton, that actually converted the Civic Center to a geothermal system. And they claim that they got a payback for the entire system investment in a matter of 8 months. That's a pretty short time frame. It's certainly a larger larger building than the average home is in Minnesota. But I do think that, you know, no matter what the payback is, I've never heard a payback time that is longer than 14 years. But the lifespan of these systems is thought to be about 30 years, and I think the technology is at the point now where it at least ought to be a consideration when we're looking at spending dollars for conventional systems for state buildings. It does seem to me that this would lower the cost of delivering government services for a long time into the future. Even if we just if we ask those state buildings that normally you know, that normally have their utility bills to pay, if they just were to return the same amount to the state treasury that the state spends on the geothermal system, that we'd still have 15 to 20 years of basically, you know, heating and cooling that costs about 10% of what heating and cooling would with conventional systems, and just for the electricity use. So, you know, it seems to me it's certainly a viable option. The time for consideration of energy issues seems to be this year. So, you know, I'd ask for your consideration on that, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. There are a couple of other people who want to speak to this, and I believe they're both here. Peter Moll from the Landscape Arboretum that's owned by the University of Minnesota, yeah, put up a new building that I understand has about 40,000 square feet, and he is willing to give us some testimony on their experience with geothermal. And then Dave Shield, the owner of Inner Earth Energy, is also here, and I think if those two people would come to the table at the present time, well, we can ask them to speak to this bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Kubley. So, Mr. Moe and Mr. Shield, welcome.
Yes.
Who would like to go first? And if you'd identify yourself.
We'll ask Mr. Moe to go first, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
The University of Minnesota built a visitor center building at the Landscape Arboretum.
I'm sorry, just for the record, would you identify yourself?
Peter Moe, Director of Operations at the University of Minnesota Landscape Arboretum.
Thank you, Mr. Moe.
The Arboretum privately raised private funds to build a 40,000-square-foot visitor center building that opened 2 years ago. Prior to the building being built and designed, we did a pre-engineering study with Ellerby Beckett, and they highly recommended that we consider a geothermal system based on the energy savings every year, as well as not a great premium on the construction costs. We ended up deciding to do that because even though we're part of the University of Minnesota, we pay our own operating bills every year, including all of our utilities. In addition to that, the Arboretum tries to use environmental models whenever they can. We have model demonstration gardens, prairie restorations, stormwater runoff parking lots, and other things like that, so it fit in with our mission very well. And so we built that. We initially budgeted our utility bills at only 20% less than it would have been with a conventional system, and there has been money left over in the energy budget every year, which is always a plus for me being the director of operations. It works very well. And one of the things we like about it is that we have 12 heat pumps throughout the building. We don't have big chillers and cooling towers and things outside because our visitor center is built right in the gardens at the Arboretum. So we don't have the noise or the space or the visual impact of those units, plus they're expensive. We can customize the heating and cooling in the building. Sometimes you're cooling in the wintertime when you have a lot of people in a small room. Other rooms, if they're not being used at all, the heat pumps can almost be shut off. So we can very easily, with a computerized system, customize the heating and cooling to save energy and be comfortable. The air in the building is clean. We're not burning any diesel fuel or natural gas, so we don't have any worries with carbon monoxide in the building. And of course, there's less carbon dioxide produced without having those combustion sources. So it has been a very good system to operate, and we're very pleased with the energy savings every year in our annual budget.
Mr. Moe, a question for you. Is there a limit, some limitations as far as physical space you need to install these systems?
Well, we're a large facility. We drilled 250 wells 200 feet deep, but they all fit in a parking lot that holds about 200 cars. So for a building our size, we actually had to build another parking lot that we built as a rain garden. We easily could have accommodated those additional wells. And, of course, there's other options for using slinky fields, horizontal fields and things too, but most public buildings have either parking lot space or adjacent lawn space or sports fields that can be used for the well field.
Okay, thank you.
In addition to that, I'm Dave Shield of InterEarth Energy for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Shield.
In addition to that, there are engineering solutions for geothermal installations that cover a broad range of technical problems. Deep wells, multiple wells, it can be resolved in a very small area. I specialize in urban retrofits for residentials, and I was able to fit a 6-ton geothermal system in a yard 40 feet wide and 130 feet long. So certainly the technology is there for any engineering solution to address issues just like that.
Okay, that's good to know. Well, you want to continue with the further testimony, or Mr. Moe, you're done?
My background is I'm a geologist, and I worked for 15 years for Conestoga Rovers and Associates, an environmental engineering firm in New Brighton. My specialty was design and installation of Superfund treatment systems around the United States and Canada. And my specific specialty was drilling and excavating construction supervision on large projects. Geothermal interested me 2 years ago when my interest in sustainable development and the sustainable planet started to increase with the geopolitical issues that we see facing us today. My company's mission statement is modeling economic growth through environmental sustainability. I think this could be a good model for the state as well, as far as budgets and monetary concerns are considered. Market incentives will drive by necessity sustainability and not necessarily legislation, but that doesn't mean that legislation can't help set the tenure for market incentive sustainability. Geothermal systems can help us through efficiency, economy, and by helping the environment. Geothermal systems are measured in what's called a coefficient of performance. For every 1 kilowatt of electrical energy that you put into a geothermal system to operate it, you get an average of 3.5 kilowatts of heat back from that system. And therein lies the economy of the project. Let me back up for a second. I went to a dinner party on Saturday night, and a friend of mine, as I was explaining to him geothermal systems, he was an engineer for 3M, he said, "What is this, some kind of perpetual motion machine that, you know, you get 3.5 for one that you put in?" There's a lot of misconception about geothermal, but basically what it is, for those of you who don't know what it is, it's capturing solar energy, compressing it, which increases the heat from the ground temperature to 130 degrees, and then redistributing it as a heat source with a forced air or radiator and hydronic applications. So we're actually using physics to compress a unit of heat into a smaller area. Proportionately, the heat goes up. And that's the magic. So literally, for every one unit you put in to operate these projects, you get 3.5 to 4 units of energy out of them. That's the economy. A lot of people, when talking about this, either municipalities or residences, get sticker shock when they see the initial upfront cost of the systems. For example, the system I put in my home is $22,000. But what I'm replacing is $2,300 worth of fuel cost per year. So my payoff on my system is an immediate 11% return on investment because I'm not buying fuel. I already subtracted out the $300 a year it costs to operate my system. So I went from $2,500 a year down to to $300 a year in operating costs for my heating and cooling system. That's substantial. The Iowa Energy Center, where I did my coursework, followed the retrofits of 100 schools. These schools reported recovering between 13 and 24% of their operating budgets by switching to geothermal. Not their maintenance budgets or their heating and cooling budgets, their overall operating budgets. Utilities are only second to payroll in percent of budgets in most school districts. What we're talking about here really is redistribution of capital through this project. Our state and individual citizens, in our nation, 40% of our entire petroleum budget is heating and cooling. That is a huge, huge market share. And geothermal is poised to take over that market share. If someone were to come up to you and say, what could you do with an additional 13 to 24% in your budget this year, you'd probably clamor to listen. And that's really what we're looking at right now. In California, the Public Employees and Teachers Pension Fund own a combined 160 million square feet of office space. An energy-efficient initiative proposed by the California State Treasurer would invest $200 million to perform physical retrofits in these buildings to improve energy efficiency. Upon completion, the estimated annual energy savings are expected to be $40 million per year, providing a payback on the investment in only 5 years. This demonstrates the long-term feasibility of geothermal heat pumps, and especially
Chair?
On a state level.
I hate to interrupt.
Mr. Olsen. Senator Olsen.
Mr. Shield, could you go back and address the type of system that you were talking about? Did I hear you say solar in there, too? Or I need you to re-explain to me how that system works.
Okay. You have two components to a geothermal system. One is called the loop field, and that is the part that's buried in the ground.
toy.
The other is the actual heat pump that does the capture, compression, and redistribution of the heat. So the loop field in the Capitol, in a small parking lot or wherever the blueprint would be for this building, it would end up being vertical loops. So we'd drill down vertically hundreds of feet, put in closed loop systems which would capture the ground heat, circulate it through an energy recovery system, the geothermal heat pump, and redistribute that heat.
Follow up.
So that is capturing stored solar energy. 47% of our sun's energy is stored in the ground on an annual basis, and that's what we're recovering.
Senator Olsen?
The part where you threw me, because the ground temperature of the water, you're somehow or other you're heating that to the room temperature. So if the ground temperature is 55 degrees or 50 degrees, you're raising it whatever you are. How are you doing that?
Okay.
Mr. Shields.
What that is that it's called the glycol loop. The closed loop has water and alcohol in it that picks up the ground temperature. It's 50 degrees. It goes through a heat exchanger on one side of the heat exchanger. And for those of you who don't know, they look like two egg cartons inverted on each other. Lots of surface area for easy physical heat exchange. The glycol passes through the heat exchanger. On the other side of the heat exchanger is a type of environmentally friendly freon called R410. It boils at 40 below zero. So it immediately picks up the 50-degree temperature in liquid form, is circulated to a compressor where it's vaporized and pressurized. Now, when you take 50 degrees and, say, a cubic foot, and squeeze it down to a cubic inch, the temperature goes up proportionate with the pressure. Simple proportionate rise in temperature and pressure. And that's where you get the 130 degrees. That 130 degrees is then passed through either in-floor heating or through forced air coils, much like a radiator, which then a fan blows through, stripping that 130-degree temperature and distributing it in a space that needs to be conditioned.
Thank you.
Thank you. We do have a quorum now. Mr. Shields, I have a question to follow up on that. In-floor heat, then, is that, you know, obviously that's not as efficient as a forced air system. Is that correct?
No, that's not necessarily true. It's apples and oranges. It's depending on the specific need of the client and application. It might be really good for a garage or an arboretum where you have even heat all the way for all your plants from the floor up. But in a retrofit situation, it might be better to install forced air because you do have a geothermal air conditioning component as well. These units both heat and air condition by a simple reversal of circulation of the media within the system. It literally shuts off and reverses its circulation, and then it strips the heat from the building through the return air ductwork. So you get two for one, heating and cooling for one installation. All right. Of the millions of dollars saved annually may be redirected to other programs within the state, schools or otherwise. There's a snowball effect. There's 500,000 homes approximately in the metro area that could be retrofitted with geothermal systems. I know this isn't directly related to the energy bill for the Capitol, but geothermal will provide jobs and training. Although it's a 40-year-old industry, and Southdale Shopping Mall has been heated and cooled with geothermal since its inception, this will provide an incredible amount of new jobs and a new flow of capital within the state. As the industry grows, technology will grow. There will be a higher market share for geothermal, and then that creates monetary incentives for research and developing through private funds. That technology, which we can help develop in Minnesota to support this industry, is exportable. Although the jobs developed through geothermal industry are sequestered in the state and can't be exported, because basically all the homes in the state could be retrofitted at a tremendous savings, and that will take years. So as we develop this industry, we both keep money in the state, and we'll be able to, through companies like Econar, who is a state-owned heat pump manufacturer, be able to export the technology that we develop in the state of Minnesota. The specific result of the funding and the revolving loan and retrofitting state buildings is a high return on investment. The loan pays for itself immediately because geothermal systems generate primary energy on a quantifiable, measurable level. It has a dollar value. You're talking about creating X thousands of dollars annually with a quantifiable monetary value, but at a 3-to-1 investment basis. You're putting in $1 and you're getting $3.50 out. And I don't have to explain the power behind that. There's one more component to this. The loop fields have a 200-year expected lifespan or life expectancy, but they really don't know what that is right now. The plastic that we use to install the loop fields has only been around for 50 years, but in that 50 years it has shown no wear or weathering being buried underground. They're expecting it to last 200 years. So even when the 30-year lifespan of the geothermal heat pumps for a building the size of the state capitol rolls over, and these are very simple mechanical systems, much more simple than boilers and furnaces, the parts on the geothermal heat pumps are replaceable, but heat pumps themselves are not bulletproof and they won't last forever. However, the loop field is an equity item which is equal to whatever its cost of replacement is at any given time. So putting in a loop field is pretty much like drilling an oil field, and an oil field that never runs out. You'll be able to continue to capture that energy for generations, and the state's investment will not only be paid off in maybe 5 or 10 years, but in returned revenue for generations, literally.
Thank you, Mr. Shield. We have a very tight schedule today, but if members have a few quick questions. Senator Carlson.
Sir, I have one quick correction that needs to be made. Just in the legend surrounding geothermal energy, it's not solar energy. It's energy that's coming from the core of the earth. If you are installing a geothermal system, one way to make it even better is to insulate it at the top. Put insulation over it, because as you go down in the ground, you're going warmer and warmer and warmer. And like the you experience in mines, a mine a mile deep is very, very hot. So really, what you're not getting solar energy unless you count when the earth was formed.
Actually, that's inaccurate. There are two types of geothermal energy, according to the U.S. Department of Energy. The one you're talking about is active geothermal, and it is retrieving energy from excess volcanic heat that's been stored over millennia. This type of geothermal is called cold temperature geothermal, and it does collect stored solar energy, as is typically these wells are less than 200 feet deep. And the energy or temperatures between 8 feet below and 200 feet below remain consistent throughout the year. So this is, let me clarify that, called cold temperature geothermal.
Mr. Chair and guest.
Carlson. Senator Carlson.
I would dispute that greatly, because when you're heating your home, the ground above that is frozen, and all of the heat that's being pulled out of the earth at that time is coming from below. It's coming from conduction from below. So, like I say, if you want to make it even more efficient, you insulate it from the outside. And, you know, and yes, that is all a consistent temperature, mainly because it does cycle up and down. But the ground temperature beneath 8 to 10 feet is pretty consistent. But the heat that you're using doesn't come from the sun.
Senator Senjum.
Madam Chair, may I ask Senate Counsel a question just about language on the bill? And it would be in line 111, where it talks about practicable. What does practicable mean in a legal sense?
Mr. Fuller?
Yeah. Chair, Senator Senjum, it's not a common legal term. I would interpret it it's a level above possibility. So there's some, you can do it, but there's some measure about the wisdom of doing it, such as within the budget that's allocated for it. But it's not a clear legal term, like it's not an evidentiary term. So it's more than a possibility, but it probably falls just below reasonable or somewhere along reasonable. It's, you know, you can do it. It's probably a good choice. I would say. But it's not a term that's used legally, usually. It's more of an economic sort of test.
Madam Chair and Council Fuller, not to try to fix it today, but as we go along, is that the kind of term that you would want in legislation from the standpoint of clarity? And you know, there are going to be many people along the way that as they get into this are going to come to this word practicable and are going to wonder, would it be wise to search for another word, not today, but along the way?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Senjum, you might want to define it. You might want to say for the purpose of this section, practical means that it's a, you know, okay, some cost function or design function or something like that, because it doesn't have a clear meaning in this context.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Fuller, you know, could you put something together for the bill then and let us know where to insert it? Or, you know, and I don't know if you need to do that immediately, but before it shows up someplace else.
Okay. Senator Kubley, I have a question, too, that I would like to ask. And as I looked at the bill, I wonder how expensive it would be for every state project to have to come up with a design for a geothermal heating and cooling system that needed to be considered prior to any other type of system that might come along. And how do we know that in the future there aren't going to be less costly, more energy efficient forms of heating and cooling coming along?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. You know, there are a couple of amendments that I should have dealt with earlier, but one of them does address that. You know, Senator Anderson has the language, but, you know, it came from the League of Minnesota Cities. I know Craig Johnson is here. If you'd like to hear about that from him, that might address that question, because they had some concerns along that line.
Okay,
too.
Senator Kubley, I'm going to ask you to we're going to lay this over for right now. I'm going to ask you to work on it. We have some people from out of town that need to testify today, and so I'm going to ask you to do some work on it and then come back to us.
Okay. I think, you know, we also have some from out of town from the other bills that I have. Are you laying all of them over or just this one?
Yes, we had allotted 30 minutes to your total testimony for your bills. We have people that hear from the East Coast and all around. So.
All right. I was unaware of that, Madam Chair, but
okay. Thank you.
Okay, so should we plan on 30 minutes when they're rescheduled, or?
Well, you can talk with the committee administrator about that. But
all right. Thank you.
We don't have the time today.
All right.
Thank you. This time I'd like to call on Lauren Logtug.
Oh. Okay.
Welcome, Mr. Logtug.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lauren Lotog. I'm here to represent Otter Tail Power today. Since there are a number of new members on the committee, I'll just summarize my company by saying that we're a small investor-owned utility that serves western and northwestern Minnesota. We serve about 150 small towns in Minnesota in rural communities, and we serve about 1,500 farms. Otter Tail Power, Madam Chair and members of the committee, does recognize the growing concern for climate change and the need to make reductions in greenhouse gas emissions. In fact, between 1990 and 2005, Otter Tail Power actually decreased its carbon intensity at its generation plants by nearly 11%. We plan to decrease our carbon intensity by another 11% by 2020. Otter Tail Power is also committed to meet the new requirements of the Minnesota Renewable Energy Standard that Senator Anderson authored and Governor Pawlenty signed today. And finally, on the conservation front, our company has achieved more than 1 million megawatt hours of conservation since we officially started doing conservation programs and keeping track of these in about 1990. We realize that conservation is really our best source of new energy. We will be actively engaged in the further discussions that other stakeholders have with us during this session to increase our company's commitment to electric conservation. So, Madam Chair and members of the committee, let me begin by suggesting what should Minnesota do. And I'm addressing myself primarily to Senate File 145, Article 5, and Senate File 192. Our company believes that we support the proposals in the governor's bill and in Senator Anderson's bill to do these things. First, to initiate a stakeholder process to recommend policies for achieving greenhouse gas reductions throughout the Minnesota economy. Second, to assess and inventory all sources of greenhouse gas emissions in Minnesota. Third, to assess the state's capacity for effectively achieving greenhouse gas reductions in all sectors of our state's economy. Fourth, to coordinate our state's efforts with actions occurring or being contemplated at the federal level. This is very important. And finally, we suggest that we also engage the Center for Climate Strategies to assist our state in developing a full menu of options for achieving real greenhouse gas reductions. What does our company think Minnesota should not do? Our company opposes Minnesota taking unilateral action to cap greenhouse gas emissions at the state level. This presents a number of problems from our perspective. Number one, we believe a single state cap and trade system cannot be efficient. Even multi-state regional cap and trade systems are too small to provide maximum efficiency. A market with many buyers and few sellers creates very high prices. Second, for electric utilities, no technology currently exists to cap CO2 emissions on existing coal plants. When the Congress passed the SO2 sulfur dioxide cap and trade program for reducing acid rain in the 1990s, the utilities could decide to go out and buy SO2 scrubbers, or they could buy allowances in a national, well-developed SO2 allowance market. But with CO2, there are no CO2 scrubbers on the market today. Mr. Tom Houston of Energy Ventures Analysis mentioned to the committee on Tuesday that there is ongoing work to develop CO2 scrubbers for existing plants. Various technologies appear to hold promise, but there is no off-the-shelf technology that utilities can buy for this purpose today. A third reason that Minnesota should not deploy its own cap-and-trade system. Minnesota's electric loads continue to grow, and no new electric baseload plants are currently under construction. This should concern us all. I have a graph, and I think this has been provided to the members of the committee already. I have a graph that I'd like to share with the members of the committee that provides a forecast of the electric generation reserve margins that are forecast by MAP, the Mid-Continent Area Power Pool, which has taken on a new name called the Midwest Reliability Organization. As Mr. Scott Wiseman of SEED pointed out for the committee on Tuesday, NERC recommends a 15% reserve margin for the MISO MAP region. Without the addition of the Big Stone 2 plant, the Midwest Reliability Organization is currently forecasting a 568-megawatt capacity shortfall by 2011 and a 2,400-megawatt capacity shortfall by 2014. These dates are not that far away. I should point out also that the Renewable Energy Standard bill that Senator Anderson authored and Governor Pawlenty signed today assumed the conclusions of the Minnesota PUC's wind integration study. The wind integration study assumed, number one, the existence of Big Stone plant, number two, the existence of a number of other baseload plants, as well as new transmission resources associated with each one of these plants. All of these resources are critical to Minnesota's ability to provide reliable electric service to its citizens in the future. I would ask you to keep in mind that every time someone buys something at Target or Best Buy that plugs into the wall, electric demand increases. New ethanol and biodiesel plants are being proposed across the state, one of them for Fergus Falls, where I live. Oil and gas pipelines are increasing the capacities of their transmission pipelines across Minnesota. They need more electric capacities. Potential new customers want to build industrial facilities around our state. I'll only mention Senator Bach's reference to a potential new steel mill on the range as an example. Where is all the new electricity going to come from for these new loads? Now, to personalize this just a bit for my company, let me suggest that Minnesota must not make the mistake of imposing caps that prevent the construction of modern, new coal generation facilities. My company's oldest plant, a coal plant, is located in Fergus Falls. It's called Hoot Lake Plant. It only generates 122 megawatts of electricity, but it's still an important part of our baseload generation mix. Our studies suggest that we may be able to retire Hoot Lake plant by around 2017. Its two units were built in 1954 and 1959. But if we're prevented by a premature state CO2 cap and trade program from constructing our company's share of the Big Stone 2 generating plant, we will be forced to keep running our Hoot Lake plant. Let me point out that the old plant generates just 811 kilowatt hours per ton of CO2. The new Big Stone plant will generate 1,051 kilowatt hours per ton of CO2. That's a CO2 efficiency improvement of almost 30%. Other emissions efficiency gains for SOx, NOx, and mercury are even more dramatic than this. What Minnesota really would be telling my company by passing a Minnesota-only cap-and-trade or carbon offset program is that we can't buy the modern new hybrid vehicle we need to continue going to work back and forth every day, unless we're willing to pay a fee every year for all of its CO2 emissions. Or our other choice is to keep driving our old inefficient car. Don't buy that hybrid until a new zero-emissions car is finally available. Given these choices, most Minnesotans would want to see a price tag attached to each of the options before they make their decision. In conclusion, my company stands ready with all the other electric providers in Minnesota to study all aspects of achieving sustainable reductions in greenhouse gases. And we would recommend the provisions in the bills that I mentioned earlier that will work toward that end. Thank you, Madam Chair, and I will answer any questions anyone has.
Any questions or comments from committee members? Could you leave us a copy of your comments?
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to make copies for all the members of the committee.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Larry Johnston.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for your time today. I'm Larry Johnston with Southern Minnesota Municipal Power Agency. I've testified on a number of occasions before even the new committee members on the RES, so I think you have a pretty good feel for us. We're a small municipal generation transmission company serving 18 municipal utilities throughout the state. What I want to share with you today, hopefully this is coming around and it should really shorten our process. The Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association has developed a series of position papers on a number of items that confront them. Many of you were able to receive those last week when MMUA was at the Capitol. There's quite a bit of information on here, but I really just want to emphasize, once you get these, I want to emphasize 6 points, and I've highlighted them in yellow on the back to maybe facilitate the process. First of all, as we begin to look at what we think Minnesota should do in terms of climate change, well, I guess I should mention one more background piece, because I do sit on a national climate change task force sponsored by the American Public Power Association. And a number of the things that we are advocating at the state level, we do, in fact, advocate at the federal level and have worked with our congressional delegation to try to get them to move forward in these particular areas. But first of all, we believe that any program that we ought to be looking at in Minnesota ought to be national in scope, if at all possible. We do have some of the same reservations that Mr. Lawtong talked about in terms of putting Minnesota businesses and particularly Minnesota consumers at a disadvantage by taking unilateral action along that line. Probably the most important thing that we see is that we believe any program ought to be economy-wide and it ought to apply to all sectors. Ultimately, slowing, stopping, and reversing CO2 is a yeoman's task. It's a huge task. And there's no silver bullet to do this, and it's not going to be accomplished. We're not going to get to the targets we want unless we have everyone playing in the process. We understand that it's easy to get at the electric utilities, but we think if Minnesota is going to look at something serious with this regard, we need to look at a comprehensive approach across the board. And so we would hope that any study going forward or any work with the Center for Climate Change would really focus on that issue. Thirdly, strategies must allow Minnesota to compete. Again, we need strategies that aren't going to put Minnesota businesses at a disadvantage with potential reduction in jobs as a result of that. The strategies that we look at must, in fact, maintain and retain reliability. We can't forget the sort of things that Lauren was just talking about in terms of the fact that there's a huge amount of energy required over the next several years. And those of you who have a tendency to watch what goes on at MISO, the last couple weeks during the cold snap would have been interesting for you. If you're watching the MISO LMP charts on every five-minute basis and you see just how tight this particular region was in terms of supply, and very legitimately you can look back at that and you can say, gee, Sherco 1 was out of service, King's out of service. But when you begin to look at about a three-state footprint where you have very high congestion and you're unable to move things around in that three-state area, I guess you need to ask yourself, are we comfortable with the thought process of one or two of the large facilities we have being outputting us in that particular situation? Correlates very well with the graph that Lauren was talking about. So we have to make sure that we maintain that reliability, and we do need to understand that we need the generation and the transmission that's out there. Everything's going to need to be in the mix. We need to make sure that the aggressive renewables program that we put in place is there and that the transmission is there to deliver it. We need to make sure that there's new coal, advanced coal, nuclear, gas, and the transmission, again, to deliver those. We're going to need those all to meet the requirements of the future. Most importantly, what we can do right now is energy efficiency, cost-effective energy efficiency steps, and there are a lot of additional things we could be doing in that area. So we really want to stress that. And I think the final thing is that research, development, and deployment of new technologies is paramount, again, if we're going to adequately reduce these greenhouse gases that we're seeking to reduce. Probably the watchword in that, there is even a fair amount of research done, but there's very little work done on deployment, especially deployment of any scale. One of the things that has been a huge argument at the national level over whether or not you want to look at a cap and trade, you want to look at a carbon tax, how you want to approach this, is that regardless of the methodology that you employ, you need to ensure that there's sufficient dollars that are funneled to research. Again, it's one of the areas where I guess we're less inclined to be excited about the fact of doing this on a state-by-state basis. We'd like to see the dollars go into a federal coffer for the purpose of doing this advanced research, and particularly research in terms of deployment. So, again, we support a thoughtful process. Quite honestly, we're willing to work with the Center for Climate Strategies. We're welcome, you know, we welcome to engage ourselves in that dialogue, but we want the process to be very thoughtful. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to try and answer them.
Any questions or comments? Senator Dahl.
Madam Chair, thank you. Mr. Johnson, I agree with pretty much most of what you're saying here. I hope that your group will lobby hard then on the federal level to get those research dollars in so that we can see that technology brought into the marketplace. The need is there, but, you know, that's I think groups like yours can really make those pushes. I also have introduced legislation to try to study and capture as much the maximum benefit we can from the economy, especially here in the state. So I think we're working on all these measures, and we agree with you. So,
Senator, I appreciate that comment. It is one of the things that we have worked on and do continue to push at the federal level. Just as an interesting aside, people often wonder why people maybe look at cap and trade versus taxes. One of the things that we're very concerned about is we don't think that people should leap to one particular solution. Again, if we're going to try to get to the carbon reduction targets that I think everybody intends us to try to get to, you're going to need to look at each of those sectors, whether you're looking at the utility sector, you're looking at manufacturing or agriculture or transportation, and I think you need to look at each of those sectors and determine what are the methodologies you can best use to try to get those carbon reductions, what tool best fits that, and select that tool. It may, in fact, be a cap, maybe a cap and trade, maybe a carbon tax, maybe some hybrid of the two, but they're all a little bit different in terms of how you try to get people to those targets. Interestingly enough, one of the reasons why a cap and trade is favored over a carbon tax at the federal level is because people are concerned that if it is a tax, it will get into federal coffers and it will not be controllable. They believe that based on, again, using the model of SO2 cap and trade, that if you're using a model like that, that the revenues that come in from that can be very easily segregated and go back to where they need to go. So that's just one of the reasons why people are considering that. But
thank you.
So, Mr. Johnston, I'm trying to hear from each of you what ideas you have that you think might be employed. I hear that plans that are laid out there seem difficult, and you wonder how we would implement them. But I'm wondering what ideas you have that where you think we might go forward.
Madam Chair, as I mentioned, I think we have a very aggressive move in terms of the renewables. We're going to be talking very seriously about conservation improvements and where we might be able to go with those. I think it might be interesting for Minnesota, who really enjoys being a leader, to look at something entirely different in that conservation area, maybe as an addition or maybe as a replacement. This is something I think you're beginning to see kind of in vogue in other areas at the moment. But as a utility, one of the problems we have is we can design very, very creative rebate programs for our program, you know, for the initiatives and technologies that we want to put forward. And we can find aggressive ways to market those, but we still ultimately find ourselves with the consumers facing a choice in terms of what they want to do. Sometimes quite frustrating to the utilities, to be honest with you, because somebody may make a technology choice that may not be the sort of technology choice we would like to see have happen, and then we end up spending ratepayers' dollars to change out a piece of equipment that really maybe still has useful life in it, but we'd like to change it out because we can garner other efficiencies. Something that might be worth considering might be taking a look at forming some sort of a commission or regulatory body with the concept of setting efficiency standards for equipment to be sold in the state of Minnesota. I know that there are certain issues with that in terms of federal preemption as it relates to the conservation acts that were passed two decades ago. But it's an interesting idea. Whether or not it's stated in terms of something like no more incandescent light bulbs after a certain date, or it's stated in something a little bit more maybe creative in terms of lumens per watt. But that there are some targets that people can begin to try to design programs for. And there's really no reason why it would have to stop with those sorts of things. When I first got into doing efficiency measures, it kind of astounded me that, you know, we were always working to try to find different levels, like with high-efficiency motors, to push the customer towards, whereas, on the other hand, Canada, for example, worked with manufacturers and was trying to push them towards an actual efficiency level to establish. So it's a bit different track, but what it can do is it can, if done correctly and not putting, you know, consumers and retailers in horribly in harm's way, where the technology is one that's suitable to be adopted, I think that it holds some interesting potential. Maybe it's difficult at the state level. I see yesterday Australia was announcing that they were thinking of doing a very similar sort of thing with the incandescent light bulb. Maybe much easier to do nationwide, but again, I guess as we begin to go through this, I think there are things where we know we can take some action that we can begin looking at those areas.
Okay, and then on this issue, Senator Jungbaum.
Just kind of a statement as we're thinking things through, Madam Chair and members, is I don't know if you guys keep hearing kind of the same thing. It always seems like we're trying to look at reinventing the wheel, and I get back to Tillman has shown us that there's so many technology things, the plant biology and what Tillman discovered on biograsses and stuff. There's a lot of grassroots things we can be thinking about doing without reinventing technology, working on other things in carbon capture and sequestration. And I hope more as people come to the table, they start thinking in terms of not reinventing the wheel. What can we do in real terms today? What do we have the technology to do? And yes, we need to keep moving forward. We need those research dollars and things, but it's always troubling. And I go back to Tillman because he was the only guy that came and did a presentation and gave us some solutions, say they're available today. It's not something we got to reinvent.
Well, you know, Senator, if I might, Madam Chair, an interesting thing, I don't know, there was a pre-release of this last Wednesday. I don't know how many of you picked up on it, but have any of you seen EPRI's comments that have recently come out on what it is EPRI's been thinking about in terms of how to at least deal with the electric sector, if you will? Along the line that you're thinking, you kind of caught my attention when you said that. Because one of the things is I would also hope that we would not get caught up, if you will, in thinking that electricity in and of itself is the problem. There may be instances where, quite frankly, electricity happens to be the solution. And one of the things that EPRI is very interested in is, in fact, plug-in electric hybrids. And depending upon how you view even the current generation fleet, there are people who estimate even in the current generation fleet that if you were to switch folks out, you know, what's the estimate? 75-80% of the travel is like within 25-30 miles. Okay. Even if you were to use existing electric fleet, people are seeing that there could be like maybe a 30% improvement in CO2 on that sector. So your point's a wise one. But I do think, in fairness, I mean, if you begin looking at a graph like this where I'm sorry, I can provide this to the committee if you'd like. Where you begin looking at these segments, this very large orange segment, if you will, well, the red segment, let's start there on top of it, is advanced coal generation at much higher efficiency levels. But this huge orange chunk is, in fact, carbon sequestration. And we do need a lot of research. I mean, if you take that chunk out of there, you're going to have a hard time being below those 1990 levels, I might add, okay? But that's an area where we have all kinds of interesting questions around that. I mean, yeah, you can talk about different approaches, as Mr. Lautung mentioned, for trying to do the capture. But when you start compressing CO2 and putting it into the ground, you know, as a liquid, there's real questions over exactly are there environmental issues with that? Are there potential groundwater issues with that we need to be careful of? So there's, especially at the scale, I mean, I think everybody can kind of demonstrate that these are all conceptual things that are workable. But that's where I think when I talk about research, I'm very interested in research dollars on at-scale deployment. Many of these things you can talk about and make work a little bit at a time. Talking about making it work in the scope of how it needs to be deployed to get to where we need to get, that's a much different question.
And Mr. Johnston, you touched upon reliability, and I'm not sure that for those of us who aren't in the industry, that we often really understand how important electric reliability is. And I'm wondering if you can expand a little bit more on that.
Well, I'm not sure that I'm absolutely the best one to do that either, but the reference I made about MISO was an interesting one. What I was trying to, you know, when we had the folks from MISO in here on the RES discussion, I think they were giving us an indication of, you know, how close we are to the edge at the moment. And I think that's really what I was trying to discuss with regard to where the MISO prices are. I mean, this time of the year, you might expect maybe prices per megawatt hour to be in the probably in the $30 to $50 range. When we hit that cold snap, 2 weeks ago, roughly that range, we saw prices in the Minnesota hub in the $350 range. Now, what that is, I mean, why those prices are there when you understand how MISO works is that they're trying to incent people to do different things because there's congestion and you want people to not have generation that can't flow on. You don't want to do that. But, I mean, those prices are an indicator of how difficult it is for us to move electricity across the region. Okay, and you can look at that and you can say there's a couple plants out. Cherco One was out. King is out. But I guess if you're seeing that major shift where you're seeing multiples of what you would expect the price to be, it tells you how close you are. And I guess my concern is if one or two of our plants can put us in that situation, and we're not talking about the growth that's coming behind it. That's what makes the discussions we've had with regard to making sure that we can get the generation that's planned online and the transmission that's online. I think the only other thing I might add to that is one of the things I've seen in the efforts to limit or to get offsets for or to sequester, that was limited to, I mean, that all fossil fuel was included in all of those agendas. And that also then is going to include the natural gas that we expect to be able to use to follow the renewable generation, particularly wind, in our standpoint, with the wind that we're putting in as an intermittent resource, you know, the load following that we're going to need to do with natural gas. So we've got a lot of things that we need to put in place, and we can think about it, but I would much prefer to think about it, then set targets, and assume that we can get there.
Do you, as we ramp up on renewable energy, is it conceivable we could do without coal-powered plants?
I find that very difficult to believe. Well, let me restate that. I would find it difficult to do without that kind of base load capability, whether it's a coal plant, whether it's an advanced coal plant, whether it's a coal plant with carbon capture, whether it's a nuclear plant, but without that base load capability, yes.
Any other questions or comments?
Madam Chair.
Senator Sharon.
You did not highlight this on your report, but I was interested if you just briefly talk about your concerns about regional differences and fairness and effectiveness of any program.
Well, here's where, Senator and Madam Chair, here's where you get the benefit of the dialogue that you always have to go through in dealing with the regional differences in Minnesota. This is one of the things that came out of the national task force that I'm working on. I think that nationwide, most people recognize that we have one heck of a wind resource here. And, you know, wind is one of the technologies that has become more mature and is therefore kind of a technology of choice in the renewable vein, if you will. I run into a lot of my counterparts in the Southwest and in the southeast that are very concerned that somehow people will begin advocating that wind is the solution, and that and they quite frankly don't have anywhere near the wind regime that we do. Some of them have some pretty good wind regimes, but they happen to be located in spots that are recreation tourism areas or national preserves that they think it would be extremely difficult to actually sight wind in. So some of these folks are beginning to simply be concerned and saying, you know, please don't come up with a methodology, if you will, in terms of talking about how we're going to get there with renewables, for example, that would specify this is the type of resource that you would have to employ. Many of the people in the southeast are much more interested in agricultural-based methane. They're more interested in looking at if you will, landfill gas recapture, those as the options. So I guess what they're saying in that vein when we had those discussions is the understanding that through different regions of the country, if you will, there will be natural competitive advantages given the resources that are at their disposal, and be careful how you do that so you don't limit people into a target, for example, that they can't hit. Nationwide trading programs in terms of renewable energy credits would help mitigate that, frankly. But that was the concern that was expressed amongst that group.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Johnston.
Thank you.
Deborah Bergen. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Deb Bergen. I am manager of State Legislative Affairs for Missouri River Energy Services. We are a municipal power agency with 60 members located in Minnesota, Iowa, North, and South Dakota. 24 of our members are located right here in Minnesota, mostly along the south and the South Dakota-Minnesota border and near the southwestern part, northern border of Iowa, the state. And I'd like to thank the committee for the opportunity to testify on Senate Files 145 and 192. Missouri River Energy Services does understand the desire of lawmakers in Minnesota to take action on climate change. However, taking state-specific action should be approached with the utmost caution. Global warming is, in fact, global in nature, and any approach should be national, if not global, in basis. In the upper Midwest, in this area, carbon dioxide emissions as well as energy production cross state lines. For example, Missouri River Energy Services has members in four states. Action in one state influences and affects actions and costs in other states. Therefore, we support that any policy looked at recognizes that fact and considers looking at something more national in nature rather than state-specific. Additionally, any policy passed should apply to all industry sectors, not just utilities. It should look at transportation, manufacturing, and even our own individual consumption habits, since that also contributes to emissions in our daily lives. Any climate change legislation aimed at the utility industry must also consider, as Mr. Lawtog and Mr. Johnston just pointed out, the demand for electricity and the simple need to keep the lights on. It has been estimated that the region's demand will increase another 6,300 megawatts by 2020. This is despite conservation efforts. Even with the aggressive renewable energy standard that was passed by this legislature earlier this session, according to the Wind Integration Study, an additional 5,000 to 7,000 megawatts of power will be needed to meet that demand. That's in addition to the wind that will be built to meet the renewable standard. And that will be baseload generation needed for reliability. It is needed to sustain reliability, to follow the fluctuations in load and demand, to provide power when wind is spotty or not available, and to keep lights on. Again, this growing demand for electricity cannot be met by wind alone. You need baseload. According to the wind integration study, again, it indicated that there are times when wind just is not blowing anywhere, if you can believe it, in this area of the state. In fact, the situation occurred just this month. during the coldest part of this year, at the same time that MISO was calling for a generation alert due to extreme shortage of generation in the MISO footprint, MRES's wind generation was actually using power, not producing power. And this was, in fact, during that cold snap, common for all the wind generation in Minnesota, Iowa, North and South Dakota. So it is a real consideration we have to be aware of. In addition to this immediate need for more power, climate change legislation should also consider the status of climate technology. Mr. Johnston gave you a good overview of where technology is at. Carbon capture technology is just not commercially available right here, right now. For example, the first IGC demonstration facilities are just now being considered and planned. And utilities like Missouri River Energy Services will watch and we'll see how these plants go, what operational or other considerations may come up during construction and operation, and we'll look at other climate control technologies that's available. As a participant in Big Stone 2, we are concerned about keeping Big Stone 2 project online and bringing it to the region. Again, let me reiterate, we need Big Stone 2 because we need power in this region. Growth and demand is not reducing, going down anytime soon. MRES in particular will need new power online by 2012 to meet our growing needs. If Big Stone 2 were not built, MRES would be forced to build natural gas peaking facilities, which also emit greenhouse gases, in order to meet demand in the short term, which again subjects customers to fluctuating natural gas prices. Additionally, we would be forced to purchase power on the market, subjecting customers again to great fluctuations in prices and to higher costs overall. As Mr. Johnston referred to, over the period of extreme cold we had this past month, there were periods in which power sold on the spot market for $360 per megawatt hour, nearly five times what it would normally go for. Owning baseload generation is much less volatile. It promotes stability of price and reliability of resources for our customers. Another consideration for any global warming or climate change technology is economic development. Growth in the economy is tied to electricity. As gross national product goes up, electricity consumption does rise too. Each development project in the state brings new electric demand, but it also brings new investment and new jobs to the community. It is firm, reliable power that keeps these manufacturing plants online and keeps providing good-paying jobs to Minnesota citizens. Finally, I urge this committee to consider supporting the study, the stakeholders group portion of the bills, so that you can study the need to balance certain considerations in any climate control policy. Any legislation, and the stakeholder group must look at this, should consider the national scope of the issue. It should apply to all industry, not just utilities. It should consider the status of technology and that technology's cost effectiveness at controlling greenhouse gas emissions. It should maintain reliability, and it should be sensitive to economic development and rate impacts. The power supply and transmission system is very complex, and unintended consequences would be disastrous. Like the wind integration study, the potential impacts on rates and reliability should be analyzed first, and we encourage taking that type of approach, like we did with the wind integration study. Take the time and look at all aspects, look at the balance before you take action so that you've met all these considerations and have considered all the moving parts first. Thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Bergen, I appreciate your testimony. I just think you're maybe missing one big risk area, and that is it seems to me that if you're going to build your Big Stone plant, I assume that'll be around for decades, I mean, once it's built.
I believe it's a 50-year. Madam Chair, committee members. Senator Anderson, I believe that would be a 50-year lifespan.
And Madam Chair, even if we do nothing, Madam Chair, I think everyone is accepting the inevitability that there will be carbon regulation whether it's a cap and trade nationally or a carbon tax. You know, we've heard that from all the testifiers. And so what, you know, wouldn't there be a tremendous impact on ratepayers sometime during the next 50-year lifespan of that plant? That plant will not be a good investment. It's going to dramatically change the balance sheet from what it is right now.
Ms. Bergen.
Chairman, Senator Anderson, committee members, first of all, I should add that Big Stone 2 is being built and designed carbon capture ready so that when the technology is commercially available, that it will have that ability to be retrofitted. Additionally, as there was testimony in the Certificate of Need process, it is still the most economically viable facility being built in this region. I could find further information on the cost and the rate impacts and get this to the committee. I do not know those off the top of my head. I apologize.
Madam Chair, I'm just not aware of any technology that's on the drawing board to capture carbon dioxide from a plant such as the Big Stone plant. It's not, because it's not a gasification plant. I think that's the only technology with the potential for capturing all the CO2 emissions, and even that is not, it sounds like, not commercially viable. So I'm skeptical that possibility exists for that plant. And I guess maybe we should get some more information on that, Madam Chair, sometime in the future.
Ms. Bergen, did you have any further comments?
Yes, Senator Sloan, Senator Anderson. I can find further information on that. My understanding is there is some research and development right now on carbon capture technology, and I can certainly find more information on who's doing that research and what status it is. In addition, and that is something different than IGCC.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Senator Alcine.
Madam Chair, Ms. Bergen, I have a concern that you alluded to and Mr. Johnston, and that's this peaking demand that the price jumps up to $360 a megawatt. If gasoline went up 20 cents, they're talking about federal investigations for price gouging and all those kinds of things. Can you kind of walk me through the procedure that price can fluctuate that much?
Ms. Bergen.
Chairman Sullen, Senator Alcine, I am not that well versed in the MISO market. I can tell you that $360 was the spot market. It does have to do with demand at the LMP. More specific than that, I would refer to Mr. Johnston or someone with a little more knowledge of the day-to-day MISO market. The MISO market is a day-to-day market and does fluctuate. Why that particular spot rate was at $360 that particular day, I cannot tell you all of the characteristics that went into it. I apologize.
Senator Alcine.
Pretty technical question, so I don't I don't feel but I would maybe ask
I would remind you that Mr. Johnston commented on the same thing, though, too, and there was indication that the wind was not blowing at that time, and so there was less power available.
Madam Chair, I believe that it would be important for this committee to maybe get some background, not necessarily from yourselves, but some of the power companies may be able to present us with how does this spot market work? Because I think it can affect our decision. And we're being told that, you know, prices can go up six times. Is that, you know, what triggers that? How would that affect our decision on cap and trade? So I think it is pretty relevant, and I would appreciate maybe some more information at a future meeting.
We'll look for some resources. Thank you. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just responding to a couple of things. I'm not sure I heard that it was because the wind wasn't blowing was the reason, you know, we had the peaking problem. It was the cold itself that was creating the crunch in energy, and you know, we have so little wind now, I don't think we can attribute that $316 to the lack of wind.
No, I think it was a number of circumstances, and I believe it was that there was a high demand at the time because of the cold stretch and the wind wasn't blowing, so there were less sources of energy available.
Well, I'd be interested in understanding that better.
And Ms. Bergen, can you respond to that?
Yes, Senator Sullen, Senator Dibble. I would recommend that one of the best people to discuss that would probably be someone from MISO, and they could tell you exactly what goes into the spot markets. Additionally, my limited understanding of the MISO market is that price is also influenced by transmission constraints.
Okay, Senator Dibble.
And then earlier, Madam Chair, you asked for more information about the carbon sequestration ideas that are out there beyond what IGCC plans. I'm interested in knowing specifically about the statement that Big Stone is going to be built carbon sequestration ready. I want to know specifically what that means.
Yes, and Ms. Bergen has offered to get us more information on that.
Well, it sounded like it was more general information about R&D that was out there in the future. She said she implied that something specific was being affixed to this plant to be ready for something specific, and I'm interested in that.
Okay, Ms. Bergen.
Yes, Senator Solon, Senator Dibble. Actually, the plant is being designed as carbon capture ready. I'm not the best technical person to answer this, but it is designed so that you can cut into the stack and add carbon sequestration technology when available. Again, I'm not an engineer. I can actually bring to you information how that actually works. I can't answer it further.
Okay. Senator Dibble.
Thanks.
Okay. Ms. Bergen, if you could provide us with some information, that would be helpful.
Absolutely.
Okay. Any further questions or comments? Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, may I ask a question before
Senator
you move on?
Sharon.
There is a cap placed on the current level of emissions, what happens to the plans that you're making for improving transmission lines?
Ms. Bergen?
That were projected in the wind study.
Senator Solon, Senator Sharon, I'm not sure I understand the question. I can say if, for example, Big Stone 2 were not built, the transmission project is of course tied to the plant, and that particular project would likely not be built. Is that what you're asking?
Senator Sharon?
And were those transmission lines included in the wind study as a part of the transmission's assumption about the potential of wind to resolve some of the renewable energy issues?
Ms. Bergen.
Senator Solon, Senator Sharon, yes, that was a basis of the assumption in the wind integration study.
Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Thank you for your comments. Mm-hmm. Next is Mike Robertson. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mike Robertson. I'm environmental policy consultant to the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I have been involved in environmental legislation at the Minnesota Legislature for 30 years. Back in the 1980s, for 9 years, I was assistant and deputy commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency. The Minnesota Chamber of Commerce is committed to work with stakeholders and policymakers on the next step to address the issue of greenhouse gas emissions. I say next step because you have already taken significant action in the passage of Senator Anderson's bill, the renewable energy standard of 25% by 2025, signed by the governor today. The RES will have a major impact on greenhouse gas emissions in Minnesota. You also have before you other bills that seek to achieve greater reductions in energy use through conservation and efficiency programs. Advancing renewable energy and reducing energy consumption are significant actions that will reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So, what should be the next step? We support Article 5, Section 4 of Senator Pretner Solon's Senate File 145. This section requires the Department of Commerce to establish a stakeholder process that will develop a comprehensive climate action plan for Minnesota that will be ready for your review in the 2008 session. The governor has already begun the process. He has engaged, as you've heard over and over in the last two hearings, The Center for Climate Strategies, a nationally recognized organization of scientists, technical and policy experts, and facilitators. The Center for Climate Strategies has worked with 11 states that have completed climate action plans and is currently working with 7 states, including Minnesota. Without a doubt, the Center for Climate Strategies model will provide the most comprehensive analysis of all sources of greenhouse gases in Minnesota in an inclusive process that will engage leaders from Minnesota business, agriculture, advocacy groups, and government. In addition, dozens of Minnesota technical and academic experts will participate in working groups that will provide information to the stakeholder group. The process includes an emissions inventory and forecast of future emissions. The inventory will identify the sector sources of emissions, including electrical generation, as you've spent so much time talking about, but also the other sectors of transportation, industrial, residential, and commercial, agriculture, and waste management. Hundreds of options for reductions will be analyzed and ranked. Where are the greatest potential for reductions? What is the potential cost or cost savings to achieve the reductions? For example, just taking the transportation sector, the stakeholders will review options on vehicle technology and operation, reducing vehicle miles traveled through incentives and disincentives, and fuel options for passenger travel, freight, and off-road vehicles. The costs and benefits of all of the options in all of the sectors will be compared and prioritized, and the final plan will recommend options that will achieve a goal with measurable reductions over time and estimate the cost and cost savings to achieve the goal. The process will also consider reporting mechanisms and emissions registries so that progress can be credibly measured and credit can be given in any future trading program to emitters making the reductions. Upon review of plans that have been developed in other states, it appears that some of the greatest reductions over time result from a strong commitment to renewable energy and energy efficiency and conservation through demand-side programs. With the passage of Senator Anderson's Renewable Energy Standard and further work on demand-side efficiency, the legislature this session will take a giant step forward to reduce Minnesota's greenhouse gas emissions. The next step, the development of a state climate action plan, will ensure that Minnesota has a comprehensive policy that addresses all emission sectors in our state. As I noted, we believe that Senator Pretner Solon's approach to this issue is the best way to move forward. The legislation requires development of a comprehensive plan but does not predetermine the outcome. Senator Anderson's Senate File 192 requires the state to implement a cap-and-trade system by January 2009. Variations of a cap-and-trade system may be appropriate options for consideration at the federal level, but it has not been shown how this would work with Minnesota alone or with the few other states that have similar programs. How much will it cost the ratepayers of Minnesota? What will be the impact on economic development and the ability of Minnesota businesses to compete? Those are questions that could be answered in the stakeholder process. Here are the greatest fears of Minnesota businesses. We're going to go it alone as a state. My energy costs will be higher than my competitors. How will I compete? How can I expand my business or bring new industry to Minnesota with such a competitive disadvantage or, at a minimum, cloud of uncertainty? We believe that it's not prudent for the legislature to act without the important input from the climate strategy stakeholder process. Cap-and-trade policy options and their impact on the state will require significant cost-benefit analysis. We have not seen such an analysis thus far, and we doubt that it could be produced in the time for your consideration this session. The work of the stakeholder process is intended to provide the basis for these critical decisions. We believe that the legislature can take climate change credit for your tremendous step forward in reducing greenhouse gases by passage of the RES. We urge you to take the next step and support the Center for Climate Strategies process to develop a comprehensive climate action plan. I'd be happy to answer any questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Are there any questions or comments for Mr. Robertson? Senator Carlson.
Madam Chair and Mr. Robertson, you said that there are other states that have this policy, have already done this policy?
I was speaking specifically about cap and trade, which testimony you heard, I think, on Tuesday, talked about California and a group of eastern states that California just passed a cap and trade system, and the group of eastern and northeastern states are working on that process as well.
And Senator Carlson, I'll draw your attention to a handout that we have. It's called States That Have Passed Emission Laws. On the third page, there it mentions the states that are involved in a cap and trade system.
Just my question, Madam Chair, and Mr. Guest, was you mentioned that some states have already had a climate action plan developed. Did I miss?
Oh, yes, Madam Chair, Senator, yes. With the Climate Strategies Group, they have developed 11 plans in other states, and they're working on plans for 7 other states, including Minnesota. So there's a track record on how that works. I've looked at the process that has occurred in those other states. With regard to all of these different sectors, they have a list of 300 different options to look at in terms of how to reduce greenhouse gases. Many of the plans have focused on about 50 of those 300 options to develop further and to make recommendations to the various sectors, the legislature, or elements of the state government.
Madam Chair, Mr. Robertson, have those plans
been published?
Are they available to us?
Yes, you can go to the Center for Climate Strategies website at centerforclimatestrategies.org, I believe, and you can get access to those plans.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Senator Dahl.
Madam Chair, thank you. Mr. Robertson, do I understand the chamber is in support of Senate File 145, is that correct?
That is correct.
And Madam Chair, and if thank you. If the plan goes through and the study is done and the recommendations are made, will your members, as the concerns they have, you think those will be addressed? Then they won't. If we still have to go it alone, as a state.
Madam Chair, Senator, I believe that the process will yield many, many recommendations that Minnesota can implement alone. When you look at where the reductions need to be made in each of the sectors, what you see is that either individual action or some kind of corporate action needs to be taken to achieve a reduction. And with regard to the business community, we think that many of those reductions will be done with the cost savings. If you reduce your energy use, you're going to reduce your cost. So we think that there will be many enthusiastic business community members once we present them with the information. The chamber is looking at developing a program where we can work specifically on energy conservation and efficiency with our members much more aggressively to get them to take advantage of the many programs that are available under the Conservation Improvement Program to make those energy reductions, which will result in reductions in greenhouse gases.
Thank you.
Senator Anderson.
I'll pass.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Robertson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Michael Noble.
No, thanks. No. Oh, Madam Chair, just while that's
Senator Anderson.
His seat, I'm having an announcement of a forum next week that I was got an invitation to that committee members may be interested in at the I think it's at the university. It's sponsored by the International Center on the Economic Impacts of Climate Change.
Okay, thank you. I'm just being informed that there is a stakeholder meeting on Senate File 192. It's been moved from 10 o'clock to 9 o'clock
on Monday. Thank you.
And where is that located?
It's in this room, I believe.
Okay, this room.
Everyone's nodding.
9 o'clock.
Yes. 9 o'clock Monday morning.
Okay.
Thanks.
Madam Chair and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Molly Schultz, and I'm the Public Policy Director for the Minnesota Environmental Partnership. I've joined Michael Noble here to testify. I just wanted to talk briefly about why the Minnesota Environmental Partnership is in support of Senate File 192. MEP is an umbrella organization. We have about 80 member groups throughout Minnesota, and those 80 member groups represent 500,000 Minnesotans. And so if you think of yourself belonging to one or two environmental groups, you're actually only counted once, so there are actually 500,000 people in Minnesota who belong to these 80 groups committed to environment and conservation interests. And this year, the Clean Energy Minnesota Package was overwhelmingly selected by our members as one of our top three priority issues that we would be focused on through this legislative session. And the reason for this is that everywhere we have gone over the past few years as we've been organizing, we keep hearing from Minnesotans who are telling us something is wrong. Our winters are getting shorter, our summers are getting longer, things are changing, and there is a problem. Minnesotans see that global warming is disproportionately affecting Minnesota. We're an outdoor state. Our jobs, our economy, our lifestyle, and our way of life rely on the protection of our natural resources. And Minnesotans are telling us overwhelmingly that they see the effects of global warming and climate change on our great outdoors. Just a couple of examples, as we have seen, we've heard from anglers and hunters that they see that the ice is going out a lot sooner. It's forming later. They see changes in the wetlands. They see changes in the habitat. They're attending forums and town hall meetings that we're holding. We've had events all over Minnesota that have featured notables like Will Steger and Paul Douglas, who wanted to talk about global warming. And every time we hold these events, we think, well, maybe 30, 40, 50 people will show up. We had an event down in Austin and Albert, in Albert Lee, where we just showed a documentary on global warming and invited people to come and watch it and talk about global warming. We had room for about 20 or 30 people, and 150 people showed up. I mean, this is clearly something that is on the minds of Minnesotans. But overwhelmingly, what they're asking us is, what are you doing about this? What is the plan? They're telling us the time is over to stop talking about it and to stop studying it. And they're telling us that it's time for action and it's time for Minnesota to be a national leader. So based on that, we are standing, the Minnesota Environmental Partnership stands with our members who are working on this. We stand with Michael and Clean Energy Minnesota, and he's going to talk about that in a minute. We believe that we're in a position to finally give Minnesotans what they're asking for. They're asking for a solution, and we believe that this is the best solution for the state. So with that, I'll turn it over to Michael.
Mr. Noble.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Michael Noble. I'm the Executive Director of Fresh Energy, and I'm speaking today on behalf of the Clean Energy Minnesota Coalition. Includes Center for Energy and Environment, Clean Water Action, Clean Up the River Environment, Institute for Ag and Trade Policy, Isaac Walton League, the Land Stewardship Project, Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, Minnesota Project, Sierra Club, Union of Concerned Scientists, Wind on the Wires, and Windustry. And these groups are a subset of the 80 environmental groups in the Minnesota Environmental Partnership who are working most closely in a most coordinated fashion on the broad legislative agenda, the Renewable Energy Bill, the Energy Efficiency Bill, the Global Warming Bill, and the Advanced Biofuel Bills that are working their way through the legislative session. I have a handout that describes briefly the bill in front of you that you're considering today. Yesterday I found myself in broad agreement with much of what the Chamber of Commerce said to you today. And yesterday, Governor Pawlenty spoke at the Chamber of Commerce, and then today he spoke at the bill signing for the Renewable Energy Bill. And I want to highlight a couple things he said. Yesterday he said, you know, we're reaching a tipping point on these issues, and we're actually past the tipping point. We've moved beyond the question of whether or not we have a problem to how are we going to work together to address these problems. And today he reminded us of his call for reducing fossil fuel consumption by 15% by the year 2015. And essentially the governor is pushing all the state, all the citizens, and all the legislature to begin to take action on these issues, with his clear message that we have a problem and we need to get organized and get going to solve the problem. There is no disagreement that we need a serious plan and an economy-wide strategy. We're in full agreement with the comments that every testifier made today, that that's what the planning process should do, is look at the entire economy, look at these 300 strategies, figure out what the cost of them are, figure out how they can be coupled together to get the best and most cost-effective plan. We're in full agreement with that, and that's what our bill language does. The only difference is that we're saying to this task force, here are some benchmarks that you should look at and price out for the legislature. First, price out the governor's position that we should reduce our fossil fuel emissions by 15% by 2015. Give us a rough idea how that would be done, what that would cost, how that would work. Then, if we're going to get to the goal that we need to long term, let's look at two numbers in the 2025 range. Cost that out. Maybe one of them will save Minnesota $1 billion. Maybe the other one is going to cost Minnesota $1 billion. But let's get the numbers and see what it would take to reduce our emissions dramatically in the 2025 time frame. And the third number in our bill is basically the science. It's not an advocacy position to say that we need to reduce emissions by 80%. It's not an environmental opinion. It's the physics of the matter. All the scientists in the world and our governor are saying that we have a problem that needs to be solved. And to reduce the emission, to stabilize the concentrations in the atmosphere, to have the problem stop getting worse, to have that problem stabilize, we have to reduce emissions by 80%. That is the critical thing that you have to think about. And we're going to have a lot of political debate as to whether we can reduce by 80% in 30 years, 50 years, or 100 years. But to have the problem stop getting worse, we have to reduce emissions by 80%. What this bill is about is getting started. The planning process is getting started. Giving the planning process some guidance as to what you want to see when they come back is about getting started. And the cap in 2015 in the electric sector is about agreeing that the problem is going to stop getting worse. You can have one of two positions. Either emissions can keep going up or emissions can stop going up before they start coming down. And all the word cap means is that by 2015, emissions won't be higher in the electric sector than they are today. Now, I have really, really good news I'm going to pass out here. You're well on your way to accomplishing this. The bill that was signed into law today, the 2020, actually, by blending the two numbers, the Xcel Energy number and everybody else number, it is actually 25% renewable energy by 2020. And the bill that you'll be soon considering, the Senator Dibble's proposal worked on with Senator Prettner-Solin and our coalition and many others, the energy efficiency proposals, those two things combined will more than enable us to reach our 2015 benchmark of not having emissions be higher than they are today. So that what I'm handing out, this is analysis that's been done jointly by the Isaac Walton League of America. I'm going to highlight Shalini Gupta over here. And the Center for Energy and Environment, Keith Butcher, our analyst there. They've looked at all the data, all the numbers. These are all based on state data submitted by the all the utilities and the resource plans. And if we implement the energy efficiency bill that's going to be heard by this committee and the renewable energy bill that's already been signed into law, the cap is not controversial. The cap has no controversy because we'll have made it. In 2015, our emissions will not be higher than they are today in the electric sector. So with that, I want to give a full balance of time to two brilliant people that speak to you. One from Union Concerned Scientists, she's next. And then Minnesota's, not speaking on behalf of a coalition, but Minnesota's most esteemed academic expert on energy policy from the Humphrey Institute are here to speak to you today. And I hope that you'll stay to the end of the hearing to hear them both.
Mr. Noble, I want to ask you a question first, though, about your assertions. You said that if we pass Senator Dibble's bill and with the renewable bill that we passed and was signed into law today, which was a glorious event.
It was.
That we will cap our emissions. But does this then, does this assume that there is no further growth in Minnesota during that?
Madam Chair, excellent question. these data, again, I'll walk you through it. Starting in the black line, the bold black line at the top, is showing how growth is expected over the next 25 years. This presumes that the electric system is growing just slightly under 2%. That's a long-term trend. Some utilities are growing faster. Some utilities are growing slower. But overall, the system-wide growth is in the range of about 2%. And that could be debated. It could be a little higher or a little lower, but that's the assumption that goes behind it. It's a 1.8% annual growth. So if we do nothing, if we had neither bill, then emissions would continue to grow. These are CO2 emissions over time in the electric system alone. Emissions would grow from approximately just slightly under 60 million tons of CO2, would grow up to about 85 million tons of CO2 by the year 2025. Now, you can see the energy efficiency bill essentially cuts the growth in half, if you will. We'll drop the growth from 1.8% per annum down to, say, 0.3? Well, we'd be reducing it 1.5%. And then you can see that the renewable energy standards that have been passed into law essentially takes the growth out of the system. It takes the pollution growth. It doesn't take the energy growth out of the system. It takes the pollution growth out of the system. So there's what I'm saying to you is there's nothing. And so you'd actually be way below the 2015. In 2015, you'd be low where you are now. And the fact that this law says you can't be higher than you are now, the pain is gone and the controversy is gone. So the idea that this is a very aggressive or very scary bill is just not borne out by the data. It's completely doable and completely economic. Now, quite frankly, reducing emissions by 80% by 2050, that's a hard stretch. And that's why we have this Blue Ribbon Task Force about to be appointed with all the best data and all the best research and all the best policy analysts at their disposal. And what you'll get back by passage of this bill is you'll get back a plan to show the governor's proposal that 15% by 2015, reducing emissions by that much, our two proposals, the 225-25 benchmarks, and they're just kind of sensitivity analysis like A or B, and then we'll debate it all again next year. So we don't believe our bill is highly controversial or, controversy is controversy, but we just think it's a very pragmatic first step.
Okay. Thank you.
Chair.
Senator Senjum.
Mr. Noble, does this chart and what it says and the goal that you've just recited, is that part and parcel of a legislative, I won't say plan, but at least initiative to kill the Big Stone plant this year through legislative process?
Madam Speaker, Senator Senjum.
Does it require that Big Stone not occur?
Madam Speaker, Senator Senjum.
Mr. Noble.
I think it's unfortunate that the Big Stone advocates would try to try their case in front of your committee because there's a stack of paper this high in front of the Public Utilities Commission, and the administrative law judge opinion is going to be out on it in a couple of weeks. What the governor's position has been that if the Big Stone plant is built, it should reduce emissions in the system elsewhere, i.e. offset emissions, so that emissions don't grow overall. So this bill is not targeting the Big Stone coal plant. This bill is saying that emissions, we either are in favor of emissions stopping growing and starting to come down, or emissions just keep growing. Those are the two options in front of us. So,
Madam Chair, Senator Mr. Noble, this is probably a question for the Big Stone people, but do you think they're able to accomplish that kind of emission reduction at this point?
I think,
Mr. Noble.
Madam Chair, Senator Senjum, I think the burden should be on them rather than on me.
Okay.
Senator Rosen.
Mr. Nobles, Mr. Johnston mentioned the carbon tax versus the cap and trade. Can you tell me what you feel about that and why you've gone the cap and trade route?
Mr. Noble.
Madam Chair, I would wonder if it would be all right to defer the question since we have one of our guests is flown in from Washington and the other it's hard to get her over here. And I have views on that, but It's not a shorthand answer.
Can we wait on that response? Okay.
Actually, I do have quite a few views on that.
Everybody will have a chance to ask their questions. It may not be tonight, but we will get these questions answered. So I think Dr. Brenda Eckwurzel.
Madam Chair, the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to come and speak with you today. I am Brenda Eckwurzel. I'm a climate scientist with the Union of Concerned Scientists, and I'm also here in partnership with Clean Energy for Minnesota. And I wanted to talk about climate change from the science perspective, because that's where my area of expertise is, and how it relates to Minnesota, because I'm very excited by the actions you have taken today, which is a very historic moment, which I really feel proud to be here in the state while this happened. Okay. First, I will just talk about what the science has gathered data on, what's observed, just ever so briefly, and then go into the climate drivers, because I think that what drives the climate, what causes climate change, ever so briefly, because it's so important to get that historical perspective in our understanding, and it relates to where policy perhaps applies the pressure points to help solve the problem, and also what are the risks that we are trying to avoid, and then quickly future choices. February 2nd of this year in Paris, many scientific experts finally released, with the signing of the United States government, as well as 113 total country representatives, went through line-by-line approval of the summary for policymakers from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And this is a body of work that looks at the best assessment of the science to date. So this is something that the United States government agrees to all the language in the summary for policymakers, as well as many other nations around the world. So this is the state of the science. And it is unequivocal that the planet is warming, and we can see this in the top graph, the rise in global average temperature that we've seen since the last century and more ago. Global average sea level is rising and accelerating. Also, the northern hemisphere snow cover, as perhaps we have seen, is decreasing its extent, as well as many other signs of global warming. And as was mentioned earlier, I think people who are 30 years old and longer, who have lived in one place on this planet, can notice the change in their backyard. And in the Great Lakes region, you've already seen that the winters are getting shorter. The duration of lake ice cover has decreased. Also, heavy precipitation events, both rain and snow, is a more likely occurrence, and I can go into why that is. It's kind of perhaps counterintuitive how you can have large snowstorms with global warming. But if time permits, I can talk about that. So again, the climate drivers, as we all know, one of the big characters is carbon dioxide. And I think it's important to realize that we have a record in ice cores where we've trapped ancient atmospheres preserved in tropical glaciers, in Greenland, in Antarctica. We can measure ancient atmosphere. Never mind figuring out what the temperatures were at the time. We can look at that too. But when you've sampled ancient air and you look at this graph, which is from 10,000 years ago to the present, the little inset is from over 1800 to the present, and the red data is from measurements. So we have atmosphere measurements in the red. All the past are ancient atmosphere locked in the ice that we can extract and get very precise measurements. And you will see that it jumps as soon as we hit the industrial age. So we know that natural climate cycles are going on, but we have added to the burden of heat-trapping gases. When you look at other heat-trapping gases, the top panel again is carbon dioxide. Then we have methane we have from landfills, from rice paddies, from many different activities that humans have been embarking upon. We also see a similar spike since the dawn of the industrial age. Nitrous oxide from our agricultural practices and other activities, again, we see the spike. So it's very likely that this is unprecedented in more than 10,000 years. So this Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, approved by the governments, 113 governments' representatives, including the United States, signed this language that you see right here. And what they find is that it's very likely that emissions of heat-trapping gases from human activities have caused most of the observed warming since the mid-20th century. And very likely, the IPCC wants to help guide policymakers. It's not policy prescriptive. It's just policy relevant. So how confident are we? So very likely, in IPCC language, means greater than 90% likelihood. That's about as certain as you could get in scientific assessments. Okay, what are the future risks? Minnesota, unfortunately, happens to be in a region that is risk for large consequences if we take the high emissions pathway. And that's because the land areas are warming faster than the ocean. Also, the higher latitudes are warming faster. I went on 5 icebreaker ship expeditions to do my research in the Arctic Ocean. And in 1991, when I first was up in the North Pole, I was astonished. And in 94, when I went back to the North Pole, I was astonished that we were seeing declines in the Arctic pack ice. And when you look since 1950, it's been steadily declining. The higher latitude regions are feeling the brunt of this. In Minnesota is in a land area in the center of the country in a high latitude region. You're right where global warming will be accelerated. So when you see graphs of global average temperature increase that the Intergovernmental Panel for Climate Change projects, you better add on top of that for Minnesota, because you'll be hotter here. But we don't have to do this path. This is one of the more aggressive, they have scenarios for emissions. This is a higher emission scenario. This is a lower emission scenario. We can even avoid these consequences if we were to pass legislation nationwide around the world to take aggressive emission reductions. So some of the consequences that are laid out by this Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change don't have to happen, because we could turn this around and reduce our emissions. So these are really just guidelines. If we wanted, the IPCC says if you follow this emissions pathway, the models show this. If we follow the other emissions pathway, this is the likely outcome, and this is what is important. For Minnesota, if we were to follow business as usual, perhaps in the summers, there's a likelihood that Minnesota summers might feel more like Kansas. These are the different types of issues you would have for agricultural pests, for lakes being able to freeze in the winter, and things like that. So it's something that involves our backyard. This is, I think, the most important aspect of climate change, is the carbon dioxide as a climate driver. This is how the earth and the oceans, the trees, everything take up carbon dioxide. And the rate that is incorporated into the earth atmosphere ocean system is something called the burn cycle. And this is this calculation here. And what I've done is, if you just take 1 year of emissions, just 1 year, how long will that last? So, for example, if you have the upper level, it will decrease. This is going out 13 centuries. So our choices about carbon dioxide affect our children, our grandchildren, their great-grandchildren. A quarter of that carbon dioxide is lingering for a very long time. So if we emit a lot today, then that means that's more heat-trapping capacity that atmosphere holds on to for a very, very long time. If we reduce, then the heat-trapping capacity of the atmosphere is similarly reduced. So that means that this is just 1 year of emissions. If we keep adding and adding, it's like we're on a shopping spree on our credit card right now. The atmosphere is completely neutral, but it is registering all the choices that we make with our energy use. And so carbon dioxide has the longest-lived memory in the atmosphere. Nitrous oxide also has a very long memory. The carbon dioxide is very important heat-trapping gas. Methane, for example, has about an atmospheric lifetime of about 10 years or so. So if we make mistakes legislating that, we can catch up. With carbon dioxide, the message is we have to act soon. We've already inherited the climate that our parents gave us. And when they first started making the Ford, the first cars. So this is so key to understand that the science tells us that with carbon dioxide, we don't have time to lose. So that's why I'm very excited that you're considering taking the lead. The nation's capital is listening to all the states and watching how this is playing out. And every time something local, state, action happens, it sends a strong signal. So we can get what many wish is for a national action on this. And there is hope because we can turn this around. So we want to avoid some of the larger tipping points that are out there. We are very close to some dangerous tipping points. Some look at we want to try to not raise global average temperature above 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit, above pre-industrial levels. Right now, we are looking at, in order to do that, the evidence says that we probably in the United States would have to reduce our emissions by mid-century on the order of 75 to 90% or about 80%. It's a tall order, but the initial direction that you take is so important because we are emitting a lot of heat-trapping gases now, and that has a long history. Every year that we make a reduction, the sooner we act, that means it will be easier to make that long-term target when research and development can kick in, when we might have better ways of storing carbon sequestration and so on. There are many, many options, but we might as well implement the off-the-shelf solutions, which just haven't had the willpower to implement them. So I just wanted to thank you for your time today, and I will take questions perhaps after the next speaker. Thank you.
Thank you. The next speaker.
Just quickly.
Senator Olsen.
Madam Chair, so I know you're a climate scientist, but.
Senator Olsen, we're going to wait and take questions after.
Oh, thank you.
Okay. Dr. Brenda Wilson will be the next speaker.
Oops.
What did I say? I'm sorry, it's Dr. Elizabeth.
The new one?
No. Dr. Elizabeth Wilson.
Thank you very much, Madam. She's from here. Madam Speaker. My name is Elizabeth Wilson. I'm a professor in environmental and energy policy at the University of Minnesota at the Humphrey Institute in Public Affairs. And I wanted to start off today, actually, by talking about some of the ways that we frame the climate debate and also focus on the key role of state policy within this. Secretary Bodman recently said that we're a small contributor, we meaning the U.S., are a small contributor to the overall emissions when you're looking at the rest of the world. But I think this is a very disingenuous framing, and I wanted to highlight a little bit why and build on the testimony earlier. And when you look here, you have the United States with 22% of the emissions and China with 16% of the emissions. But that's a wrong way to think about this problem. And one of the more useful analogies, I think, that has been out there is thinking about this issue as a stock and flow problem, essentially a bathtub, where we have the carbon emissions coming in, but given the long lifetime of carbon dioxide and the slow exit of CO2 from the system, you know, to the first order, we can think about this as a bathtub with water coming in and the emissions and that stock of CO2 building up in the atmosphere and that low removal of the CO2 from those natural processes. And so when we're thinking about this issue then, it's much more important to realize that the emissions that are given out today are going to be in the atmosphere for a long time, but also the U.S.'s share of the emissions in the total atmosphere today are around 26% compared to China's 9%. And when we're thinking about mitigating greenhouse gases and stabilizing atmospheric concentrations, this is not like our experience with conventional pollutants, where for conventional pollutants like SOx or NOx that we have a lot of experience with, once you stopped those pollutants from going into the atmosphere within a few hours, that atmospheric concentration was also stabilized. When we're thinking about that for carbon dioxide or other greenhouse gases, even stopping the growth in emissions, you still have a growth in atmospheric concentration. Again, think of your bathtub model. Even if we have the same amount coming in, because of that long-lived lifetime of CO2 in the atmosphere, our atmospheric concentration will continue to grow. Thus, because of CO2's long lifetime, to stabilize atmospheric concentrations, which is the goal here, we need to reduce CO2 emissions roughly 80%. That's where that 80% number comes from. And so in the last chart here, you can see that it's the dramatic reductions that are necessary for that leveling of CO2 concentrations. And this key factor points to a needed transition both in how we think about energy, how we produce energy, and how we use energy in society. And also highlights the importance of action today. So, again, when we're thinking about this issue, I think it's important to keep in mind that the goal is large reductions over the long term. We're not talking about 5 to 10% here. We're not talking just about you changing your light bulbs. That's a part of it. But we're talking about larger structural changes. And I think, you know, I work in policy, and the key role of state policy here is to allow those types of changes to happen and to foster that environment and infrastructure for that economic investment, for that innovation within our technological systems. And the first step, I think it's auspicious to be here today with the Renewable Energy Standard just signed in a few hours ago. And with this new game and with these new rules, clear policy signals are key. Given the long-lived greenhouse gases and also long lifetime of our energy infrastructure, electric power plants, the coal-fired power plants, having lifetimes of 40 to 50 years, it's important that from a policy perspective, consistent long-term goals are available. And an 80%, a long-term 80% reduction goal gives the investment climate, gives the innovation climate, and the financial community ability to respond to and orient themselves towards those long-term goals and transformation. And state policy is crucial for starting this type of argument. You mentioned before the other states that have acted on this issue, in part because they see this as an economic competitive issue. By having some policy in their states, their businesses, their industries, their state environments are learning how to respond to, keep track and account for carbon, trade carbon, and integrate those changes that are necessary in the long term. Why electric power emissions? Right now, they're about 40% of U.S. Carbon dioxide emissions, and they're growing. And the long-lived infrastructure, the long-lived expensive infrastructure, is an important consideration when you're making investments of hundreds of millions of dollars in your infrastructure, and it will be around for 40 years. A 1 gigawatt power plant, for example, will produce 5 to 10 million tons of carbon dioxide annually. Over a 40-year lifetime, that's 200 to 400 million tons of CO2. This compares to Minnesota's annual emissions of 100 million tons a year. So again, these are large emission sources. This is a study that was done by Cabby Jones and Steve Taff at the university that just show where the CO2 is coming from in our this is the Upper Midwest study that they did. And you can see the transportation sector as well as the electricity sector being very important for this source of carbon dioxide. And this is a slide for me that I wanted to end with before I just said one or two more points. But for me, what this highlights is really the role of state policy. This is a graph, years on the bottom, from the California Energy Commission, where you can see the residential energy use in kilowatts per capita. While the U.S. Kilowatts per capita has continued to rise, California, through their state policy initiatives, has really been able to stabilize that residential energy use. Here's where an Energy Star home fills on this. Here's where Berkeley is, even lower than the California average. Again, the role that the state and city policies are playing on these abilities to bring this forward. And here's Minnesota, a little bit lower than the national average, but not much. And as a point of comparison, here's where your average Dane shows up in this per capita measure. So when we're thinking about this issue and framing this issue from a policy perspective, it's important to remember that the greenhouse gases are long-lived, and a stock and flow type diagram, and understanding that that 80% emissions reduction is necessary for the atmospheric concentration levels to stabilize, and that inaction today locks us into higher atmospheric concentrations into the future. Not doing something locks us into a future of higher atmospheric concentrations of carbon dioxide, and that these deep emission cuts are not going to happen without a clear policy signal and a clear policy environment. And this is necessary both to steer innovation and investment, and it's also a clear signal that business, that industry, that institutions are going to need to be able to adapt to this challenge. What we're talking about here, given the scale of these changes, is a full-scale reorientation of how we make and use energy in society. And I mentioned before the electric sector being a good place to start, in part because of the long lifetime of the infrastructure. I mentioned the age of the plants and the high emission levels of a lot of the electric power that we use here in the upper Midwest. And, again, that financial environment to make these investments is also important to consider. And I want to thank you very much for your attention and your time here today. I appreciate it.
Dr. Wilson, what makes the difference between the Berkeleyite and the Minnesota on the graph?
Exactly. I mean, that for me is a real key question. And California has aggressively pursued policies and emission standards for their appliances, for their homes, that have gone beyond what we've been able to do here. And you know, we can argue that in California it's a little bit warmer and they might have a lower demand because of the heating. But within Minnesota, if you looked at the variation of our best performing homes and our average home, it's also quite dramatic.
Okay. Senator Alcine, we can go to your question now.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With such esteemed scientists here, I'm having trouble understanding, you know, why we can't just simply separate two oxygen molecules from a carbon molecule and have it separated like that.
Call it a day.
Yeah. What is so difficult about it?
Certainly natural processes and
Dr.
sun photosynthesis. If we could recreate what nature is able to do on that level, it would be a big breakthrough. But in fact, some of the more innovative solutions for example, for coal plants, is to try to harness biology and try to have these, say, I mean, it's not proven technology. I just want to say this is stuff that's out at MIT developing, that you might have big areas of algae growing from the CO2 that's emitting from the power plants, and trying to, and then you harvest that, and then they put it into other sources. So there are ways of harnessing some of nature's gifts to help us with this process. And again, research and development in this, with a Manhattan-style project on solving this, I think could start, because the concepts are out there in nature and in our wonderful research infrastructure. It's just scaling them up, which I think Mr. Johnson mentioned, is the real challenge. But we won't have the research dollars or the will or the way unless we send that signal. And I think that I wouldn't be here today if I didn't think it was hopeful, because on the back of the envelope, it seems possible. It's just scaling it up.
Okay. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a scientific question that I'd, you know, maybe you could answer is, the intensity of the carbon is one thing, but does it matter where the carbon dioxide enters into the system? You know, you got cars at one level, you got planes up here. Does it make a difference as far as its contribution or the effects on our atmosphere?
That's a very good question.
Dr. Eckwurzel, and I have to speak your name just for the record so that it's on the tape.
Sorry for that. Thank you. It does not. The atmosphere is the great equalizer. It doesn't matter what the source is. And once it's in the atmosphere, then it's very well mixed. That is why
It is much easier to recreate global reconstruction of gases by measuring an ice core bubble than it is to recreate global average temperature. Think how hard it is with all our temperature stations all around the world to average them and have enough global coverage. Today, we can do it because we have the coverage. In the ancient past, it's very hard to create paleo records of enough resolution and in enough places to get a global average temperature. We have ideas of temperature change locally very well, very high resolution. But the atmosphere, because it's so well mixed with the carbon dioxide and the resolution of the ice cores, you just sample it anywhere and you get what the ancient carbon dioxide, methane, and gases were. So it's a big difference.
Okay. Are there other questions? Senator Sanchum?
You always ask a question, which I think I know what how you're going to answer it, but several of our testifiers today indicated that we ought to be perhaps directing our efforts towards a national solution. Do you have any thoughts on that? In other words, rather than dealing with state legislation here, should the efforts of this legislature be to work with within the network of legislatures to try to invoke some kind of a national solution?
Madam Chair, Senator.
Dr. Wilson.
Dr. Elizabeth Wilson. I think you know what I'm going to say on this.
Yeah.
And I think that national action is definitely needed. I don't think that precludes state action. And I think states on the environmental issue historically have been either laggards or leaders. And Minnesota historically has been a leader. And by being a leader, it's been able to reap economic advantages, export technologies elsewhere, and really be able to capitalize on that first mover market position. Definitely, a national solution is necessary. I also think for the state and for the benefit of our state economy, for state energy security issues, that moving today will help to start us down the road to deal with this long-term, large-scale structural issue.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to respond to that just briefly. Of course, we should have national system. That would be great. But it has been my observation that states are the laboratories of democracy, and I think it's unusual. It's fairly rare that we see significant action at the federal level prior to states beginning to take action on a whole raft of policy fronts, and that's been true about this country forever. And that's the strength of this country and the reason why we've organized this country the way we did. And conversely, I think we've seen time and again, certainly in my short time at the legislature, 6 years, the call for national action as an excuse to not act and to not do something about significant problems that face us. This morning we had the resolution urging Congress to act on the invasive species that are coming into Lake Superior in the Great Lakes. That's a classic example where we have not taken it upon ourselves. We've been simply waiting for the Coast Guard and the federal government to act, and we are paying a very severe consequence as a result of our failure to act and assert our prerogative and our authority over Lake Superior. And as a result, we have inland water species coming in and threatening our fish, our inland waters, and the like. So, it's a great question. Of course, we need federal action, but I think the way we get federal action is by acting at the state level.
Mr. Chair, can I just comment?
Senator Sanchum.
The nature of my comment and my question was along the lines that I think I heard today from some of our testifiers that there is a risk if we get too far out in front on this one, we may stand somewhat alone, at least initially, and lose some of our economic vibrancy in terms of our state's economy. And I just think we have to think about that as we approach this debate.
Senator Dibble.
One quick response. I think it's fair to consider that. I think it's also fair to consider that failure to act also threatens our economic vibrancy. You know, I think climate change, I think we've seen a lot of testimony, will affect many, many things very, very important to the fundamentals of the economy of our state. And it's fair to put that in the equation. It's also fair to think about this as economic opportunity, as the way to bolster and create, you know, lots of opportunity that there may be, as we've heard legions of testimony on in the renewable energy sector, new ways of doing business, new ways of thinking about generating energy locally, owning it locally, and the like. So, you know, when we think about cost and benefits, there's cost and benefits on both sides of both ledgers.
I'm going to jump in this, too. I've been thinking a lot about it also, and thinking that oftentimes Minnesota's the leader, whether it's in healthcare or it's in energy efficiency or in a number of different areas. And we get accolades for moving ahead, and we reap some benefits from moving ahead. And oftentimes it can be an incentive for businesses to start up or to locate here. Sometimes I get angry that sometimes we miss out on some things because then national policy comes in and we've already implemented something and it seems like we get penalized for having got ahead of the pack. But I think it's like, on the other hand, you know, there are great rewards that come to our citizens here too. So I think it's like any business. You take a risk. You calculate, you know, what are the risks and the rewards, and you make the best effort to move forward. Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, I don't know if anyone has mentioned this, but our staff from...
I did.
Oh, you did already?
Yes.
I'm sorry I missed the discussion of this, but yeah. So I just want to make sure people see that there, and this is really helpful, that there's over a dozen states that have taken action. And so I think we would not be alone. And, I think a big part of what we're trying to emphasize here is that we don't want to make things worse while we're waiting. And we're at a pivotal time right now where if we don't start setting some targets now or trying to put a limit on now, you know, by the time the federal government acts, maybe 5 years or 10 years from now, we could have made our situation far, far worse. And the damage that we have to try to repair will be so much more expensive and difficult. And I know that's hard. It's never easy to be in that point where we have to make those changes. But I think it will be sooner or later, and the question is it more harmful to wait when we know that we will have to do it sooner or later?
Okay. We still have one speaker left, so I want to thank the speakers at the table and then call on our last speaker, who is James Turner.
I do have one hand out.
And while we're changing here, I would like to tell you that next week we will be considering conservation and energy efficiency legislation. Senator Dibble has been working with a group of stakeholders and will be bringing a bill before this body. So if there is anybody that wants, and we'll be getting some background information on Tuesday, and I'd like to ask anybody in the audience if they want to testify on conservation and energy efficiency on Thursday, please notify my office, Jenny. There was one other thing. What was that? We'll think about it. Mr. Turner, you can begin.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. My name is James Turner. I am manager of environmental policy with Xcel Energy. I came to Xcel from Pacific Gas and Electric in California, where I was case manager for energy efficiency programs, the climate protection tariff, and other public purpose programs, including low-income support. Prior to that, spent 8 to 10 years in the federal government, mostly working at the Environmental Protection Agency, where I was on the team for the Kyoto Protocol analyses and the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, helping work out markets such as the Midwest Independent System Operator. I only have about one page of notes to work off here, and I will be as brief as possible given the time, and thank you for your attention. Xcel Energy is committed to action on climate change. We believe the time has come for action, for mandatory action. We are committed to clean energy future. We're supporters of a national approach to encourage the development of clean energy resources. And we have a clean energy portfolio standard that we've formally developed and had submitted to the Energy Information Administration for analysis. And that's available on their website as of about 2 weeks ago. We believe that a sound climate change policy should be nationwide. It should promote technology development, new technologies, should allow trading and flexibility, and should reward early action. Targets and goals should be based on rigorous cost-effectiveness analysis and be affordable for consumers. In Minnesota, Xcel Energy is committed to activities that result in significant CO2 emission reductions. We only have a couple of tools in that toolbox, as you're very well aware. We can generate less power through efficiency programs, or we can use lower-emitting resources. We are repowering the Riverside and High Bridge plants under the MERP. The end of this year, we'll be approaching 1,000 megawatts of wind on the Minnesota system. Xcel Energy, as you may know, is the largest retail provider of wind energy in the nation. We're very proud of that. Under the renewable energy standard, we may add up to 3,000 megawatts of additional wind to the system. We are also in Colorado embarking upon one of the nation's first coal gasification projects, and in fact, the only coal gasification project that is going to capture and sequester CO2. We're going to find that technology frontier, and that's a corporate commitment that we've made. We are meeting our future resource needs through hydro purchases, upgrades of our nuclear and coal plants without increasing emissions. Our last baseload filing in the state was a significant step in that direction. The effect of these commitments is set forth in the charts that we provided that are in front of you now. One shows our projected carbon dioxide emissions and load growth, and the other, our current carbon dioxide emissions intensity relative to the nation and to the Midwest. So we're working our way. We support state initiatives to develop Minnesota's clean energy infrastructure. That's why we supported the Renewable Energy Standard Bill. We're ready to work on energy efficiency legislation in a constructive way. We think Minnesota will be a leader and will prosper under a clean energy future. However, we do believe a cap on Minnesota's emissions, as proposed in Senate File 192, could cause undue hardship on Minnesotans, force new businesses to neighboring areas that don't have emission caps, reduce our operating flexibility, and could raise our costs dramatically, especially if things don't go as planned. And we can talk about costs and forecasting. We also would submit that there are measures that can reduce emissions through increased use of electric power, but reduced fossil fuel use in other sectors. Plug-in hybrid electric vehicles are one of those measures. Electrification of diesel truck stops in California, port electrification is a very interesting option. Again, we support climate policy that's national, flexible, affordable, and effective. Our National Clean Energy Portfolio Standard would, we believe, meet these objectives. I would mention that a moratorium on new large energy facilities that don't offset emissions will complicate Xcel Energy's planning process, could compromise system reliability. It would include facilities, for example, that would be wind firming facilities and other gas peaking plants. Carbon offset acquisition is complex and time consuming. It could add significant cost and risk to our energy procurement business. We do support carbon dioxide inventories, development of technologies such as carbon capture and sequestration, and other actions that can prepare the economy and the company for a carbon-constrained world.
Minnesota is demonstrating leadership on climate change through concrete action on the tools we know we have, which are renewable energy and efficiency, but we also support constructive state action in a number of other specific areas, which would need probably further elaboration at a different time. Goal setting, inventories, registry development in preparation for emission trading schemes, technical assistance to small businesses and individuals so everyone is aware of what's coming and what's at stake for them, state procurement policies for state agencies and green power purchases and so forth, and inclusive dialogue, not just stakeholder groups, but as broad and as inclusive as can be maintained. We look forward to working with the governor, the legislature, all interested parties to help Minnesota address these issues, and thank you for your time, and I look forward to any questions you have.
Mr. Turner, maybe on your first graph you can explain which one is load and which one is CO2 emission, between the red and the blue lines.
The load is growing and the CO2 isn't.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? Senator
Madam
Anderson.
Chair, thank you. Mr. Turner, can you just talk very briefly about the latest resource plan where you, I think you went in with a proposal for coal and switched it to wind and hydro? Can you just talk about that and the...
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Anderson, I came on board as that plan was being developed. It was filed, I believe, on October 31st, I think. And it did adapt our resource planning portfolio to include Manitoba Hydro in a much enhanced role and a significant amount of new wind resources. It deferred and essentially eliminated a new baseload plant in the process. And that was, we believe, a very important plan. Appreciate your acknowledgement of that.
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator,
I'd like to know what the cost impact was of that change and whether you consider that baseload, your new plan, or a substitute for baseload.
I'd like to let Judy approach the mic as well.
Just state your name for the record, please.
Chair, I'm Judy Pulfrell. I'm the Director of Regulatory for Xcel Energy. I appreciate the indulgence here. When we started that process, we identified a baseload need and set about to figure out what's the best way to meet it. And initially, I think we did lean towards or think that a coal-fired facility would be the ultimate choice, looking at cost, reliability, and even environmental impact. And as we went through and looked at all sorts of different options and took in information from potential vendors, came to the conclusion that or found a way of meeting what we do consider to be a baseload resource, which is the combination of a purchase for Manitoba Hydro and wind energy. And our analysis would show that that's a lower cost way of meeting our customers' needs. It's not classic baseload in that at some points we'll be producing more energy during peak times and less at off-peak because the Manitoba Hydro purchase will go through the day and wind will be blowing through the day. But what we'll be able to do is use the MISO market to, frankly, sell in at peak prices and buy back at off-peak prices, and we think that offers a competitive advantage. So when we went and took a look at the reliability cost and environmental impact, we came to the conclusion that this proposal was a better one to advance, and it's now pending before the Public Utilities Commission.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, I thank everybody for your patience today and for the testimony that has been provided, and this meeting is now adjourned.